take advantage of our friendship that way.
Intimate, interwoven stories that chart the emergence of modern Britain.
I want to hold your hand.
We are in the middle of Piccadilly Circus. Someone will see.
I don't care.
Our century-spanning drama continues in 1963.
It's going to snow again later.
Snow, not madame snow.
The new series of Faith, Hope and Glory on BBC Radio 4. Available now on BBC Sounds.
Now on Radio 4, in a change to some listings, the comedian Robin Ince is back with the second part of his live stand-up show, examining the brain's relationship with reality. This is Robin Ince's Reality Tunnel.
I was on a train once, the last train out of Tunbridge Wells going towards London. I sat on my own and a man came up to me and he said, "Hello, I've heard you on the radio. I think you should have a brain scan," which I think... was ruder than he imagined. He actually meant, "You look like the kind of person who'd be fascinated in a brain scan," not, "I've heard your sentence structure, and frankly, I think there must be something wrong. You're either missing something or there's something growing where it shouldn't be." He wasn't saying that, right? I was like, "I would love to have a brain scan." He said, "Would you like to have any details?" I said, no, "I'll just give you my email and you get in contact with me." He said, "But you can't even be sure that I'm really a scientist." I went, "Let's not bother about that. Whatever happens, it's going to be a story, isn't it? It'd be even better if you're not a scientist. I just end up in your shed, lying in a metal bin. While you bang magnets around it going, 'It really is a brain scan, it really is. Bang, bang. I can see your brain through the magnet. I can see your brain, and then you can live in my love well for the rest of your life. I am a professor.'" Sadly, it turned out he did work for Imperial, so I just ended up in a brain scan, right?
Robin Ince's Reality Tunnel.
Hello. Yeah, we don't have to start with applause or anything like that. I want to talk about reality again. I wanted to talk about the fact that sometimes we see the world and sometimes we hear the world and sometimes we hear ourselves and sometimes we are unaware. Much is invisible to us. I'll explain about brains, right? I'll go back to brains because I wanted to kind of investigate more and more of that invisible and sometimes soundless part of our world. And I was lucky, of course. I had the brain scan for fun because it was for a piece of research, right? I've done it for other people now since then as well. I've had a magnetic pole to the left-hand side of my brain, which was absolutely brilliant and actually stopped me being able to talk. And the reason they did it on me was they said, "If it works on you, it'll prove it works on everything." Even then, it was fascinating, but I worried about things. I genuinely thought, what if it turns out I don't have a brain? And it didn't matter. As long as I didn't know I didn't have a brain, I would be able to continue my life. But the moment it was observed that I didn't have a brain... and that would be the end of that. But fortunately, I did have a brain, right? In fact, this was something that was lovely that I found out afterwards. Anita, who was the woman who was actually in charge of the scan, apparently at one point, as she was scanning my brain, she went, "Oh my God, it's so big, I'm not sure I can fit it all in." And then blushed, right? Now, nothing about exterior me has ever made a woman blush. But the fact my occipital lobe had that power, and I should make it clear, by the way, the size of your brain within certain parameters makes very little difference to your intelligence. For instance, Einstein had a smaller brain than me, but I still feel has the intellectual edge, right? So... I was fascinated. I looked at the brain and I thought, that's where it all goes on. All of this activity that has plagued me, that has been going on in there. All of the seething emotions and impulses and the invisible mechanisms that are going on. And I thought of something that Ken Campbell said, a phrase that I've said many times, so I love Ken Campbell. He once said, "You is just one of the things your brain does." And I think that is fantastic. You is just one of the things. It's like when people say that thing about, "You only use 10% of your brain." Did you know that? You only use 10% of your brain. That's not true. You don't only use 10% of your brain. Though more recent research has shown that people who say you only use 10% of your brain do. But there is another side of that. We may only be aware of a very small part of the brain. Part of being human is we like to believe that we're seeing the whole picture, but we're not. We are seeing a tiny part of our world. Most of our world is us hurriedly putting together a picture of guesswork, a picture through habituation, and then again, as I said before, much of it which is invisible to us. And that to me is again fascinating and beautiful to remind us that it is all in our mind, that this world that we see as an outside world, is an inside world. Quite often when I'm doing shows, right, I meet lots of interesting people and they've often got questions. And one was, I was doing a book festival, right? And I was leaving the site and suddenly this mother came up to me and she went, oh, I'm so sorry. I know you're probably about to leave. I'm so sorry. My daughter's got a question. Is it okay? Can she come over? I said, of course it is, of course. Bring your daughter over. And her daughter came over. Her daughter was maybe 10. She goes, hello, I've got a question. How can I be sure that I'm not just a character in someone else's dream? How great is that question? Now, when you first hear that, you might think, oh, we can bat that away very quickly. But you start dealing with the nature of perception and the world we see, and it turns out it is much harder than you imagine. Each time we got to a point that appeared to be proof, there would be something that would refute it. And after about 25 minutes, I felt that I'd reached the point of persuading her that it was more than likely that she was not a character in someone else's dream. But I had put so much effort into persuading her that she was not, that I started to persuade myself that I probably was, right? So, later on that day, I had lunch, I was about to leave again, and this nasty child came up to me, not the nice, inquisitive child, this child came up to me and went, hello. You said that the universe may well be pointless. And I was just wondering, if the universe is pointless, then what's the point in doing science? And I paused and I just said, you do know it's more than likely that you're just a character in someone else's dream. And that got us through. And when I was doing the tour about the book that I did, right, every now and again, someone would ask me a question and I would say, it's a really interesting question, but I don't know. Well, I can tell you who you should go and listen to and who you might read, and I can give you a rough version. It's like the penultimate gig that I did before the first lockdown. I ended up having to try and explain black holes to Ed Miliband. It was one of the strangest... But I really enjoyed it, and I got it reasonably right, you know, from what our current understanding. And what I find really interesting in the current world that we live in is on three different occasions when I did events, someone came up to me and said, thank you very much for saying that you didn't know. Isn't that a weird world where we now believe that certainty is of such importance that we would rather someone was certain but wrong than someone was unsure? There's a beautiful thing, by the way, I just say this. There was a friend of mine, a Jewish friend of mine, who once said something which I thought was such an important thing. He said, one of the beautiful things about being brought up Jewish is that we were taught that you were allowed to answer a question with a question. And I think, again, that's one of our problems as human beings, is we always want answers. But actually, the far more interesting thing is the continual journey of questions. Albert Einstein once said, the most peculiar thing about the universe is that it's comprehensible. And then the next thing is I picked up a book that said, a superstring is a wiggly curve that moves in a 10-dimensional space-time of peculiar symmetry. And I said, maybe for you, Albert, maybe for you. And it's... I'm lost again. We are this strange creature. We believe that we're in charge of ourselves, but we're not. We're kind of post-hoc rationalisation. Thinking about sleep. There's a thing called the myoclonic jerk. Many of you will have had the myoclonic jerk. If you don't know what a myoclonic jerk is, just you fall asleep, suddenly your leg just jerks and goes, like that. You wake up and you go, oh, bloody hell. I just had a dream where my foot went into a hole and I've woken myself up. Who's had that? Yeah. Right, that's a very common thing. That's not what happens at all. What actually happens in that situation is you've just had a muscular spasm, but your mind goes, uh-oh. We better make up a backstory. Yes, you see, well, no, yeah, well, you were having a dream. Do you remember? And it was like a field, it was a rocky field, and there was a pothole, that was it. There was a pothole, or a little hole, or whatever. And your foot went in the hole, and that's what happened. You remember? Yeah. He still thinks he's in charge. Sleep is one of those things that reveals some of those kind of moments in our existence. Like my friend Sarah Parkak, who's a space archaeologist. She had a fantastic dream. Sarah Parkak, I actually said this. In fact, I said to my son, space archaeologist, isn't that the best job title ever? And he just went, what about chicken sexer dad? Anyway, so, yeah, he's off TikTok again. And... But Sarah had this dream, like she's an Egyptologist. And so she was out on a dig and she started to have what I can imagine is the Egyptologist cliche dream. Every night she would be chased by a mummy. And she said every single night I'd fall asleep and there would be that mummy and I'd be running and I'd be running and I'd be running and the mummy would be lumbering and lumbering. But every single time I was just fast enough to escape from the mummy. But finally one night the mummy is a little bit faster and suddenly the mummy reaches out and it grabs my shoulder and I swing round and the mummy goes, why have you been running away for so long? I've got something to tell you. And it turned out that what she had been doing, again, this wonderful thing of the way the human mind works, she, of course, had been taking in lots of information about the dig, but not all of it had been putting itself together in her waking mind. All of those thoughts that had been going into her mind had been slowly ordering themselves in the nature of a dream, and eventually she was told by a mummy. One bit of advice, someone who does have lucid dreams where you can kind of control your actions within a dream, they said, never open a bank account in a dream. You never know when you're going to be back. Dreams can change your life as well. That's the interesting thing. Jung had a dream where God did an enormous poo on Basel Cathedral, and that's what made him an atheist. And... I wish I had such an origin story for why I don't believe in God. I'm sorry, I've just dreamt that God did a very big poo and I will not be believing in him or her anymore. Thank you very much. Sometimes I like playing around with ideas. Again, they're pretend ideas. They're not real. I know they're not based in science, but they don't matter. Like, I like to imagine that when I die, my consciousness leaves my skull. It has no senses now, but it still has thoughts. But of course, the wind comes along and it thins out to nothing. And then it's just sprinkled out over nature and maybe over the possible trillions of years of the universe. Every now and again, it just comes together and I go, oh yeah, I remember that time I was in Hugh. And off it goes again, right? And in the same way, sometimes when I'm dreaming, I like to imagine in my dreams, I'm going into all the other universes that I live in. So the different versions of me in the multiverse, right? And it's not based on any science, and I think it is nonsense, but I can still have joy thinking about the possibility of that. I remember once talking about ghosts with some physicists, and they said, but ghosts don't exist. They break the second law of thermodynamics. But it doesn't matter, because they might not exist as some kind of ethereal physical reality, whatever it might be, but they do exist because they're inside the minds of human beings. I was once on the show Loose Ends with Sarah Miles, the brilliant actor Sarah Miles, who you will know from Ryan's Daughter and many other things, right? And she's known for being quite eccentric. And the moment I walked into the studio, she went, hello, I know you. I think you're going to be able to help me. I said, okay, how can I help you? She went, you know Richard Dawkins, don't you? I said, I know him a bit. Yes. She went, now, he doesn't believe, does he? I said, well, there are a few things he's not that, you know. Yeah. She went, good, good, good. Because I'm going to make him believe. Because where I live in Oxfordshire, there's a house that's very, very haunted. And I want to get Richard Dawkins and take him there and chain him to a bed and leave him there overnight. And then I'll come back. Then he'll believe. Do you have any way of getting in contact with him? I said, here's his email address. And it's just... But for Sarah Miles, in Sarah Miles' imagination, there the ghosts do exist. Douglas Adams, again, that was the beauty about reality. I was lucky enough to be a kid at 10 years old when Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy came out as a book, and I remember thinking, wow, this author has the greatest imagination coming up with the craziest ideas ever. And then I found out those crazy ideas were actually the laws of physics. How mad magical was that to find out about reality and probability and possibilities of all of these things and multiverses?
We think the universe is crazy sometimes. It's like with quantum mechanics, this thing that you will have heard said many times. Anyone who says they understand quantum mechanics doesn't understand quantum mechanics. And for some of us, that gives us a moment of solace. Ha ha! I don't understand quantum mechanics either. And then you find out that, well, as I've realized, though I don't understand quantum mechanics, I don't understand quantum mechanics on a very different level to the level that Jim Al-Khalili doesn't understand quantum mechanics. He really doesn't understand it with a very specialized lack of understanding of quantum mechanics. With scientific ideas, until there's really hard science, until the equations are considered to be in some way finished, you can still play as much as you want. You don't have to always worry and looking for an objective truth. You can have both things. You can have an evidence-based world and you can also have your imagination running wild. You can be like William Blake, who had so many different layers of experience, right? Like once he was going for a walk and he saw a thistle and he imagined the thistle as an old man and he started arguing with the old man that was a thistle, and it was real, but he also knew for no one else's reality was that true. That is a beautiful way of living, because our problem is that once we have a reality, we want to tell everyone that that is the only reality. But to have a reality where you go, this thistle is an old man, not for you, but just for me. Ah, what a freeing thing. I think this is one of the problems, is that we're meant to only be one thing. Like, I was doing some lovely gigs down in the West Country, and this person said to me, when afterwards I was chatting with someone, they went, oh, who was that woman? And I said, well, she's a hairdresser in the area, but she's also studying astrophysics. And they went, that's a bit weird, isn't it? Being a hairdresser and interested in astrophysics. And I was like, no, why should that be weird? Why can we only be one thing? Two of the cleverest people I know are hairdressers. One of them, I think, mainly became a hairdresser because she knows that when people are under her hands and halfway through a perm and set, she can persuade them out of their more irrational beliefs. She had a woman who was a flat earther, and every time she came for a perm, she would use the perm to explain how the world was not actually flat, right? You know, again, it's just that thing that we can be multitudes. I have religious friends, you know, and this is an interesting thing to me as well, which is people can hold different beliefs. Sometimes, for instance, you know, as an atheist, I think I can be overly grumpy with religious people. I think that all that matters is that you're not a dogmatist, that you don't believe in an ultimate truth that allows you to judge other people and gives you a superiority. That, to me, is the problem. I think whether you believe in a god or not is not really an issue. I reckon I would have believed in the gods if they'd kept with that Greek system. I liked it. All of those different characters. I don't like swans, but apart from that, right, all of those different characters. All of that feuding, it's a fantastic melodrama. When it just turns to one grumpy man going, well, you've let me all down ever since you ate that fruit, so I'm very cross with you. And you're all born with original sin because I'm best. Boring, right? But I have a friend of mine, Carlos Frank, right? Carlos Frank is brilliant. He's at Durham University. And he's a cosmologist. And I love talking to Carlos. And he will blow my mind with incredible research into cold, dark matter and the ideas that that might entail. And one day I was listening to Carlos on the radio and he talked about believing in God. And I was like, that can't be right. He can't believe in God. So I rang him up. I said, hello, Carlos. You're talking about God on the radio. Can I just check, when you're talking about God, do you mean kind of God like Stephen Hawking talks about the mind of God or the way that Einstein talked about God? He said, no, Robin, no. I believe in God. I went, wow. God, I never thought that. He said, I should make it clear, though, I do not allow him into the laboratory. What a beauty that is! The beauty of a God that prides itself on its omnipresence being told to wait outside. And you wait there. What do you mean, wait there? But I'm everywhere. You're not coming in. You get in the way of the equations. I'm going to be so bored. What am I going to do all day? Go to Richard Dawkins' study and hide his ammonites. Ooh, good idea, I love doing that. So again, it's that superposition of realities that we are able to hold these different kind of things. We must fight as much as possible for being a singular thing. I love the idea that, you know, when we start to accept the reality of the enormity of the universe, each time we find out a new detail about the world and the world we're in, our reality changes a little bit. Like, you know, the size of the universe now, the fact that in our galaxy alone, there are 200 billion stars. Or 400 billion stars, because in cosmology, you're allowed to be out by 200 billion. That is a beautiful thing. Suddenly, once you start thinking about the enormity of the universe, that changes your experience of our universe when you look at it. And sometimes as well, don't worry about this. Sometimes when we start to get worried, because I know a lot of people get cosmological vertigo. Cosmological vertigo is when you start thinking about the enormity of things, when you start thinking about the fact that we are related to all of the other living things on the planet. One of my favorite things, once I heard a lecturer talk about, he was doing a lecture in America. He said he loves doing lectures in America. He said, but sometimes you will get people in the audience that when you talk about evolution and natural selection, they can get a little bit cross. And he said, this one man stood up and he said, are you telling me that I'm related to apes? And he said, no, much better than that. I'm telling you, you're related to yeast. And, you know, that is... that changes your reality when you look at every other living thing and you go, how far up the tree do I have to go to find our shared common ancestor? If they did, who do you think you are? But stopped having such a speciesist version of it where we only worry about the relatives who are human. Let's go further back to that possible dandelion. This is about holding on to realities, and sometimes when we hold on to realities, not for ourselves, but for other people. My son, when he was 7 years old, it was Christmas time, and my son came in, and just standing by the Christmas tree, he went, hi, Dad. I know Father Christmas isn't... oh. And then walked out. And I thought, what's he doing? And then I realised what he'd done, was he'd walked in, he thought, I have now worked out, as an astute seven-year-old, that this idea of Father Christmas... it's obviously nonsense. But hang on. If I reveal that I believe it's nonsense, do I lose all this stuff? It's not worth the risk. I still believe in Playmobil, please. Right, so I'm going to have to try and get to an end, but we're not at the end, we're at the beginning. So, this always happens at this point when there's only 10 minutes left and I know there's 2 hours of stuff. Right, so I was going to talk about simulation. I was going to talk about simulation theory, right, but what happened was I ended up talking to this philosopher who was explaining simulation to me, and I listened to it for half an hour and I was like, okay, and I listened really intently, and then he reached for a sandwich and started eating it with a teaspoon, and I was really annoyed because if he'd done that initially, I wouldn't have listened to a bloody thing he said. Teaspoon. That's what I always do. Why didn't you do it at the beginning? Can't believe a man who eats with a teaspoon like that. This is worse than when this string theorist ate that strawberry milkshake with a fork. Leave me alone. I was going to talk about, Sartre, when he took all that mescaline and thought he was being pursued by lobsters. Don't trust him as much as I used to. I was going to talk about Plato's cave. This was fascinating to me. Edith Hall. Plato, of course, he wanted to believe that there were perfect forms, ideal forms, that we were never able to see. And Edith Hall believes this was actually because he was short-sighted. So much of his philosophy does not come, oh, the world is disappointing. Why is the world so blurry? And Aristotle was going, it's not. It is blurry. So imagine if there had been an opticians, we would have lost an enormous amount. Both Turner and Plato, a great artist and a great philosopher, going, actually, the world's fine, I just didn't know. Now I've got these bifocals, we're not in a cave at all, are we? I don't know why we thought we were in a cave. Some retinal damage has led to me wasting a lot of time doing philosophy. I don't know why I chose that for Plato, there we go. Oh, that would annoy him, wouldn't it? Why'd they give me that voice? Bloody hell, what is real? What is real, like? Niels Bohr, did I say that everything we call real is made of things that cannot be regarded as real? That was something Niels Bohr said. I don't know if I mentioned that before. Drop that in, do it in a wise way. Niels Bohr, of course, said, everything we call real is made of things that cannot be regarded as real. Because that's actually how my voice is going to be adapted for the thing to make me look cleverer. I mean, one of the great physicists of the 20th century, Niels Bohr, used to have a lucky horseshoe. And one day a friend of his said, Niels, this is ridiculous. You can't believe in lucky horseshoes. He said, I don't, but apparently it works whether you do or you don't. So it's just... There's a lovely story. No, don't tell them that story. Let them go. Let them go. Don't let them go. Then it becomes a news story. Oh, yes, good idea. So I will end now. The Stones of Callanish. Promise we'll end on the Stones of Callanish. This is about the fact that to try and strive to have an understanding that is an evidence-based understanding and to keep those different things in your mind. And I had this in the Stones of Callanish. I was at an astronomy festival. It's on the Isle of Lewis. And the guy who was organising it said, would you like to go to the Stones of Callanish? I was very lucky. I was left there alone to wander around the stones. And I started thinking about different ideas that I'd learned. I started thinking about the idea of the block universe, that beautiful idea that all of the moments in time that have occurred remain existing in the block universe, this block of time. So though we ourselves cannot go back to those moments that have been so special and so delightful, we can at least have the consolation of thinking that moment is still somewhere in time. Thinking about these things, walking around the stones, and then I just stopped in the middle and I just enjoyed the near silence. In the middle, there's this rock that's almost the shape of a palm, and as I looked at that, I thought, I want to put the palm of my hand on that rock. And as I put my palm on that rock, I suddenly had this moment of transcendence. My head became vivid with all of these different images of moments that had existed for the other people who, like me, had put the palm of their hand on that rock. And I saw people in Wellington boots, and I saw people in sandals, and I saw people in bare feet, and I saw people wearing rabbit fur, and I saw different skies, and I imagined different gods that had existed, and I saw all of these layers of time. It was as if all of these different books I'd read, all of these different thoughts I had, they all suddenly just exploded out of me, ran down my arm, my hand, hit the rock, bounced back, and I saw all of the echoes of those stories. And for me, that was very, very real, and yet also, it was as much of a fantasy as me arguing with an old man that's actually a thistle. But it didn't matter. I could have both the real world and some geological understanding, and I could also have the fantasies of my brain, and those two things could exist together as sense of a reality, but a sense of reality that also gives us some kind of hope. Last night, a ghost collided with my head. It was the light from something dead. Once it had breathed hydrogen into helium, created a beacon, projected its life across the sky. And then some of that life hit me in the eye and expanded my mind. In its size and in its power, it was grander than I could ever be. But it never knew how grand it was. It never knew the awe inspired. It never experienced its existence. There was nothing it was like to be that star, only something it was like to marvel at that star, because the stars cannot wonder about the stars. And Jupiter too is without curiosity. Me, I'm small and I'm fragile and I'm easily felled by meteorites or by microbes. But I'm pugnacious, inquiring, tenacious. I can chew on the quandaries of the cosmos. I've got a skull full of pictures and questions. And problems too. For instance, I don't like my anxiety. But then I realize it might also be my fire, because much that destroys me might also create me. There is something it is like to be me. And it's not always satisfactory. My atoms battle, my molecules revolt, but still, more than the single line of an equation or a solo chemical reaction. Confused, confusing, absurd, but flashes of inspiration. And out of my ashes may grow apples. Emergent complexity briefly defeats the void. Thank you.
Reality Tunnel was written and performed by Robin Ince. It was produced by Carl Cooper. It was a BBC Studios production.
It's all been rather lovely.